evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Tuesday, October 8th, 2019. The U.S. ambassador to South Sudan says the U.S. stands ready to impose more sanctions if the Kiir administration doesn't follow through on its commitments.
What we all have in mind when we say November 12th, we don't say with or without. November 12th, in our minds, is implementing the peace agreement on November 12th, which is a unity government that includes all the parties.
And the World Food Program in South Sudan gets a big donation.
Mostly people who have been displaced by the conflict, malnourished, pregnant and nursing women, as well as children who are under the age of five, as well as some refugees who are living in the country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Thomas Hushek says the U.S. is looking forward to a unity government in South Sudan that includes all parties that signed the revitalized peace agreement. Ambassador Hushek says he is calling on South Sudan's leaders to focus on implementing the peace deal and warns U.S. sanctions may be strengthened if that doesn't happen. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Ambassador Tom Hasek told reporters in Juba yesterday that parties to South Sudan's peace agreement should focus on implementing the deal in letter and spirit, an indirect reference to President Salva Kiir's recent statement that he would form a unity government in November with or without opposition leader Riek Machar, a statement Hasek calls unfortunate.
What we all have in mind when we say November 12th, we don't say with or without. November 12th, in our minds, is implementing the peace agreement on November 12th, which is a unity government that includes all the parties. So if you have one of the parties that's not moving forward, then you don't have a unity government by definition of the peace agreement.
Hasek says the parties need to show more political will as time to form a unity government is running out. He says the U.S. has not seen the parties demonstrate political will to resolve remaining sticking points.
So far, that's even since the extension in May, some of those have been very slow to come. The government hasn't put forward its pledged financial support for the process yet, and there's also been very slow to register forces for the cantonment. In particular, on the government side, there haven't been as many registrations. So that all needs to move forward in a much more accelerated fashion. They need to be talking about settling this outstanding political issue of the number and boundaries of states.
The ambassador says the U.S. remains on the lookout for spoilers of the peace process in South Sudan and wants the U.S. executive order to sanction any official or individual blocking peace in South Sudan will be enforced.
It's still an authority that we do have. We have a couple pieces of legislation. Part of that is because we need to protect our own financial markets, too. We don't want ill-gotten gains to be finding their way into our financial system. If a country finds out that money that was stolen from the people here or there by corrupt officials, if it's been invested in the U.S., sometimes our sanctions can help a country get those ill-gotten gains back.
The deadline to form a unity government is November 12th. Several pre-transitional activities, including security arrangements and the number of states and their boundaries, have yet to be resolved. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The new British ambassador to South Sudan says the people of the country are yearning for peace. Ambassador Chris Trott says he spoke to many South Sudanese across the country who say they want the violence to end. In the second part of our interview, Hushek says the UK, the US, and Norway want an accountability mechanism created during the transitional period to address the issues of justice.
I think that accountability is absolutely critical. Unfortunately, at the moment, we have not seen progress on that particular element of the peace agreement, but that is something that wasn't anticipated during this period. I think that our role in this current phase of the implementation has been misunderstood. It was very clear from the way in which the agreement was drafted and indeed from some of the early messaging, including from the government here in Juba, that the resources of South Sudan should be the resources that are invested in this peace process. And although promises have been made about contributions to the peace process, national contributions to the peace process, we haven't yet seen those implemented. And I'd be really keen to see the government fully committing the resources of this country to the implementation of the peace process. We recognize that beyond the creation of the transitional government, in fact, more resources will be necessary rather than less. And we're very ready to have a conversation about that as and when the government is formed. Because let's not forget that a government after the 12th of November will be a more, by definition, a more inclusive one than the current one, and will include all the parties to the conflict. And that's absolutely critical for us to then be able to have a more concrete dialogue about how we can help.
Talking about the resources, I mean, you, Troika and the rest, have been urging the government of South Sudan to use their natural resources, that is, money from the oil, let's say, to fund the peace agreement. And the government has been saying, no, the international community should come in to help.
I think that's completely unnecessary. I mean, you know, we've seen suggestions that the oil revenue has gone up, not just because of the increase in production, but also actually the price of oil has gone up over the last 6 to 9 months. So I don't think there's any need for the international community to be backfilling the process of cantonment, for example, because I think that South Sudan's own resources are sufficient for that. What we are standing ready to do is to provide ongoing support beyond the implementation of the first phase of the agreement. And, you know, I think that what we are already doing is often forgotten in conversations about resources. So, you know, the American support to JAMEC and CITESAM is very significant, as is ours. We have just announced an increased program of support to education in South Sudan worth 70 million British pounds, so nearly 80 million US dollars over the next 5 years. These are very significant numbers. Our humanitarian assistance, we had a minister here a month ago, and he announced an additional 18 million US dollars contribution to the humanitarian effort in this country. And what we need to bear in mind is that while the transitional government, the start of a transitional government, will be a very good step forward in the implementation of the peace agreement, it's not going to solve the problems of South Sudan overnight. And so we have an ongoing commitment to provide support beyond the 12th of November. And what I hope to see is an engagement, a partnership develop between the transitional government that stands up on the 12th of November and its international friends and partners, so we can have a frank exchange about whose resources are being used for what, and so that we can reassure our ministers and the taxpayers in South Sudan's partner countries that South Sudan is committing its own resources to peace, and that therefore means that we should do too.
That is Chris Trott, the new British ambassador to South Sudan, speaking in an exclusive interview from Juba with my colleague John Tanza on Saturday. Tomorrow, Trott talks about who should fund the peace agreement. As you heard, the European Union has made millions of dollars in donations and has just made a sizable donation to a UN agency working in South Sudan. The World Food Program in South Sudan has received 9.5 million euros or $10.4 million from the EU to provide food and nutrition support to many people across the country. The money will go to providing life-saving assistance to hundreds of thousands of vulnerable people, according to a WFP spokesperson. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
Thompson Perry, the WFP spokesperson in South Sudan, says the money will be used to provide food aid to 700,000 vulnerable people across the country.
Mostly people who have been displaced by the conflict, malnourished, pregnant and nursing women, as well as children who are under the age of 5, as well as some refugees who are living in the country.
Perry says of the 700,000, 520,000 people will receive cash assistance or vouchers to buy food and basic commodities from local markets so they can buy what they need most. He says it is also a way of injecting money into the local rural economy and the retail sector. Perry says the humanitarian support will target areas that are hardest hit based on the Integrated Food Security Classification Studies, which indicates the areas and numbers of people in need. He says while WFP is encouraged by plans to form a unity government soon, many South Sudanese still need food assistance.
Whilst the political processes are ongoing and there seems to be light at the end of the tunnel, South Sudan is not yet out of the woods. As we speak, some 4.5 million people are in need of food assistance in South Sudan. There are people who are still struggling to meet their food needs, and without support, their situation is likely to deteriorate.
Wang Kobwang, an IDP living in a UN-run camp in Juba, says the EU support is a lifesaver. Otherwise, he says life would continue to be a disaster since many IDPs depend on humanitarian assistance to survive. He says he hopes the EU donation means food and nutrition rations will be increased.
There is no exact change that shows there is an additional food being given to the IDP because of those money, and still the nutritional related issue as a problem is still persists. Therefore, we will not blame anybody, only that we appreciate the donation from the European Union. It's a good idea. But the way that implementation goes is actually somehow questionable.
Tech Chun, another IDP living in Juba, says he too appreciates the donation but is disappointed with the way food is distributed to IDPs. He says he lost everything in 2016 when he fled his hometown. Tech says in 2017, WFP used to give 15 kg of sorghum, a 0.63 litre of cooking oil, and 4 bags of corn soya per month. He says that didn't last all month, but conditions worsened the following year.
In 2018, they came in South Sudan, in the old IDP's camp, they cut 30% of the 15 kgs. And now we are left with 10.5 kgs per month, which could not take us not even like 10 days. So it's very difficult now.
Piri acknowledges that there were food reductions in parts of the country, but he says that was to balance the food distribution in other hard-hit areas. Piri urges beneficiaries to understand that the amount of food rations depend on the resources donated to the organization.
WFP food assistance is not meant to cover all of your food needs. It is meant to provide you enough to survive for a given period. Secondly, our assistance schemes are aligned to the amount, the level of resourcing that we get. We fundraise as we go. We are 100% voluntarily funded.
Piri says despite the slight improvement in the food security situation this year, the number of people in need is projected to go up to 5.5 million people beginning in January, because that's the time of year when households face additional hardship as food reserves from their subsistence farming start to deplete. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A new approach to dealing with the pervasive problem of children's rights being violated in South Sudan. More on that when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
when was the last time you did something that made you feel proud?
I founded my private school called Promise College Secondary School, and I'm proud of it because I want to help my citizens in South Sudan.
That was 2015 December when I took a step, because everybody was against journalism, especially in South Sudan. But when I said it is my own belief and my own interest, my own like and my what I love, so why don't I go for it? I shouldn't be listening to what other people say. It should be coming from me. If I want it, I'll have to go for it.
I think a few weeks ago, when I finally managed to balance my life socially and professionally and just get a good work-life, social-life balance.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we're talking about defending children's health and well-being in South Sudan. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, is introducing a different approach toward battling child's rights violations across the country. UNICEF's deputy country representative in South Sudan says children still suffer from hunger, insecurity, early marriage, and the preference of boys to girls' education, all of which could worsen if sustainable peace is not achieved in South Sudan. Dima Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Religious leaders, government officials, and foreign diplomats took part in a gathering in Juba on Monday to figure out how best to integrate positive behavior change in service delivery for children. Under the new initiative, churches would get involved in addressing child rights abuses across the country. Andrea Sule, UNICEF's deputy country representative in South Sudan, says churches and mosques will become points of contact to incorporate a wider area of coverage for installing UNICEF's positive behavior change initiative across South Sudan.
Not only are religious leaders and institutions well respected and command a large following, they are viewed as credible and trustworthy sources of information in their communities. They are very well positioned to have a unique ability to support the peace process, promote tolerance, and guide the communities towards peaceful coexistence and positive social and behavior change.
Sule says religion in South Sudan binds many South Sudanese together and can be very useful toward creating positive social change in communities to address child abuse such as rape, child and forced marriages, as well as genital mutilation. With this new approach, Sule says religious leaders and institutions will get involved in sensitizing and mobilizing communities to address problems like malnutrition, the high rate of school dropouts, especially among girls, and defecating in the streets. In South Sudan, a girl is 3 times more likely to die in childbirth than completing primary aid. More than 2.2 million school-age children are out of school. In addition, more than 860,000 children below the age of 5 are acutely malnourished, according to UN. An unestimated 19,000 children are associated with armed groups. Religious leaders say in the past, humanitarian organizations have not been interested understanding the role the church can play in changing attitudes of South Sudanese about bad cultural practices that harm children, especially girls. Emmanuel Enosa Penny, bishop of the Western Equatorial Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says religious leaders have been waiting for an initiative like this.
Because the churches, you know, can influence people easily. Through the churches, life can be transformed.
Bishop Penny says international organizations should intervene to build the capacity of churches so they can create change in societies. Gemma Nunu Kumba, the South Sudan Minister for Gender and Social Welfare, says it is only when peace comes to the country that South Sudanese children will realize their dreams and aspirations.
We cannot achieve the full well-being of a child in the absence of peace. Therefore, as we talk about child protection in conflict, we should also understand that a child that grows up in a violent family, a child that grows up in a violent environment, will definitely end up not having the spirit or the culture of peace in him or herself.
South Sudan Vice President James Wani Iga says the new UNICEF initiative could have a long-term impact on communities. He says South Sudanese children have suffered not only from the 5.5-year conflict, but from bad cultural traditions.
They include female genital mutilation, virginity testing, and this one still happens even up to now.
Iga says faith-based social and behavioral change initiatives are coming at the right time as the world marks the International Convention of Children's Rights. He promised that the South Sudan government would ratify all protocols aimed at mitigating violations of children's rights. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Sudanese women in Khartoum want the transitional government to suspend the Public Order Act, which they say infringes on their rights. The law, passed in 1996, bans women from selling tea or other items on the street. It also criminalizes the brewing of alcohol and makes it compulsory for women to wear long dresses and cover their heads. In the past, women caught breaking the law were flogged or charged with a crime and thrown in jail. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from Khartoum.
Althea Abbas Kuku, who is now in her early 50s, has been selling tea in Khartoum main market since 1994. She now heads the Sudanese Development Association, which brings together tea and food vendors. Speaking in Arabic, Kuku says she has been jailed several times for selling tea on the street. She wonders why the Public Order Act is still on the books when the regime that enacted the law is no longer in power.
The police used to collect our things, demanding huge amount of money within the period of 3 days. And if you do not pay, you are taken to the court and you are imprisoned for 3 months. We have been suffering from this act. That is why we are appealing for an urgent decision to stop cracking down on women and suspend the Public Order Act for good.
Kuku says women played a significant role during the recent revolution that led to the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir's regime, and says for that reason alone, the Public Order Act should be lifted immediately. 45-year-old Basamat Jabora owns a restaurant in the Suka Shabi market in Khartoum. Speaking in Arabic, Jabora says the newly formed transitional government has an obligation to protect the rights of women and their property.
As Sudanese women, we have right enshrined in our constitution and in the Human Rights Act. Our own police should not be always beating, knock us down and insult us. I expect a police to keep law and order, and he knows what his mandate is. But they should not intimidate us.
49-year-old Atoma Abdurrahim Atom has been selling snacks on the street of Khartoum for more than 10 years. Speaking in Arabic, Atom says she decided to sell snacks to support her family of six after she lost her husband in 2005. Atom says police have confiscated her utensils several times.
Some of us are really in a dire need to change this work, but we do not have an option. We need a support, such as oil factory, soap factory in these houses, or some of us can be engaged in selling bedsheets. These are some of the small projects that our government can encourage us to do.
Wafa Adam Mahmoud works at the local NGO known as SIHA, which advocates for women's rights in Sudan. She also says the Sudanese Public Order Act should be lifted immediately so that women can run businesses.
We need our economic right, we need equal opportunity, we need equal justice, we need so it will be presented to all of them, and we are going to request their contribution to advocate for this and to take decisions.
The Sudanese transitional government has yet to form a legislative body which will be responsible for enacting new laws for the country. According to the constitutional document, the Legislative Council will be composed of not more than 300 people. At least 40% of the seats will be reserved for women. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
An independent researcher has published a new report entitled Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst, outlining some of the possible scenarios in South Sudan following events leading to the expected formation of a transitional unity government next month. David Deng says the situation is unpredictable and the parties to the conflict and the international community should plan for different possible outcomes.
We're now approaching the end of 6 years of conflict because the parties have been dragging their feet and because there's a lack of really serious political will to resolve issues. Why this is relevant, I think one is thinking about the risk if the peace process doesn't unfold. So if this process collapses, we're going to be back at square one. We're going to have continued conflict. and there's going to be, you know, much more suffering in South Sudan. But then even if the peace agreement is implemented and we get the semblance of some kind of transitional government, there are also some risks inherent in that, notably the fact that we'll have a VIP protection force in Juba that's comprised of the various armed factions. And that looks very similar to the kind of configuration that led to the outbreak of violence in July 2016. So either if the peace agreement falls apart or is implemented, there are risks that need to be anticipated and managed in order to make sure that we get at least some kind of transition away from conflict.
And how about the short-term scenario where you are talking about the collapse scenario? Take us through that.
So this is a worst-case scenario. And I think here there are, again, two things I would stress. One is the immediate response to make sure that we keep open safe corridors for people to flee to places of refuge, places like churches and other areas where people seek refuge are treated as inviolable and not attacked by the parties, that UNMISS keeps its door open. These kind of short-term responses that need to be thought through ahead of time in order for them to sort of remain open. And then in the longer term, I think the collapse of this revitalized agreement, it signals a need to really fundamentally reconsider how we're approaching peace and security in South Sudan. And I think first and foremost would be the role of the region. If this peace agreement collapses, I think it's time to recognize that the region is not up to the task, that they're not able to overcome their own sort of narrowly defined interests, and that the AU needs to assert a more leading role within the mediation effort. But then I think also thinking about what a political transition might look like and maybe revisiting some of the ideas that have been put up in the past about, for example, whoever serves in a transitional government should not be eligible to contest in elections, and thinking a bit more practically about how we can get new leadership that can sort of have a fresh start for South Sudan and so we can put some of these other problems behind us.
Talking about the region, could you give us your score card of how IGAD has been mediating and steering the parties towards implementing this peace deal, the revitalized, I mean?
You know, on the one hand, I don't want to be too critical of IGAD because clearly this problem is a South Sudanese problem, and the ability of the leadership in South Sudan to make compromises in the interest of peace is what will, you know, ultimately get us out of this mess. It's clear that the region has been acting in ways that protect their interests and unwilling to sort of exert the kind of pressure that's needed to get the parties to follow through on their commitments.
That is David Deng, author of the new report, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Worst. Deng was speaking with my colleague John Tanza from Nairobi earlier today. Ali Verji, a visiting fellow at the Washington-based U.S. Institute of Peace, co-authored that report. Well, that's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Ayo by Simi.
Legendary beat.
You've been listening to See Me with the song Ayo. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and we're very happy that you made us a part of your evening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from The Voice of America.